Hi everyone, I'm Pamelia Chia and you are listening to the Singapore Noodles Podcast, your go-to destination to learn about Singaporean food culture. Today I have on the show Sherry Ng, who is a food writer and researcher. Sherry started food writing at Makan Sutra, which is a pioneer in celebrating Singapore street food, and she then pursued a Master of Liberal Arts in Gastronomy in the US. Upon graduation, she worked as a researcher, interned at a butcher shop, and starched at a Chinese-American restaurant. And now, she runs In Plain Words, which is a writing studio. In this chat, she shares about her book on prison cooking culture titled When Cooking Was a Crime, and reflects on her journey of pursuing her passion and chasing her curiosities. So when I was looking at your work, right, a lot of the things that you are interested in and the things that you write about revolve around heritage food. So how did this love begin? Where did it start? Did it start at your childhood or did it slowly develop as you grew older?
Okay, I when I wrote all these stories, I wasn't looking specifically at heritage food. I was simply looking at things that, like for example, we were talking about Singapore noodles, right? I happened to be overseas and then I was also thinking about what's these noodles that's named after Singapore that I'm not really familiar with. I was simply attracted to things that I was curious about, and that's how I started like researching all the stories that I end up like writing about. So if you're asking me how I became interested in food, then I guess it happened since young, because both my parents are foodies. They cook a lot at home. My mom used to bring me out. I mean, she's curious about food, and since I was young, she would bring me out to eat at Japanese restaurants, and she introduced me to sushi. You know, my dad, he always tells me stories. Like when he was young, he was very curious about like things that he found tasty, and then you know there was this Lao Zong Zong Ngoh Hiong store at, they used to be at the old Tong Chai Medical Center. He was very curious about this sauce, that dipping sauce that they had. So what he did was, before he went to work, he went there every day. The store opened later, so he went there every day to eat at the duck rice store next door, so that he could spy on the Lao Zong Zong store to find out what exactly they added. Yeah. And he ate there for 2 weeks, I think, just to find out this special sauce that they added. It turned out to be the kumquat sauce lah. So yeah, my parents have had a strong interest in food. I think that just
trickled down lah.
Yeah, trickled down. Yeah, and when I was young, I watched, you know, after school, I went home, I watched Yan Ken Ku.
Oh my gosh.
And Fang Tai. And I was too young to try out the recipes that I watched, but, you know, I just was very curious how these A and B add together to become C's.
Yeah, but later on you went to work as the food editor of Makan Sutra, and Makan Sutra has a very strong heritage food angle, right? What kind of helped you to kind of take up that job?
Okay, I think it's because I studied journalism when I was in uni at NTU. I didn't have a strong interest in food writing yet. You know, my impression of food writing was food reviews, restaurant reviews and recipes, right? It was until when I came across several indie magazines at the time, after I graduated. These magazines were writing about food memories what food tells, immigrant stories, essentially, you know, how immigrants in the UK, for example, remember where they came from through cooking their heritage food. So that opened my mind about what food writing is about, right? So I began to explore, and, you know, like, I didn't really have, while I was interested in food, I didn't have a lot of experience writing about food. So before I joined Makan Sutra, I freelanced for a few food magazines first. And then I found out that they were hiring, and then I applied for the job and I got it. And you are right, they are very strong at, when you say heritage food, I think it's more specifically hawker food. Sito has like he has he knows many hawkers, and I got to interview a lot of them, because he already has a relationship with them, so it's easier when I call them up and try to chat them up and find out more about the things that they do. Yeah, it's easier that way.
Yeah, can I ask how that process was? I mean, coming from the world of academia and reaching out to hawkers, because when I was writing Wet Market to Table, I had to do a few interviews with wet market vendors, and I struggled quite a lot with that. I felt like the moment you reach out to them, or like you go to them with a notepad and a pen or a camera, they instantly like recoil, or they don't
Okay, okay. I mean,
read that warmly in a way. Did you get that kind of sentiment?
it was easy for me, I have to say, because I grew up. Okay, I have to tell you that a lot of my aunties and uncles were hawkers. So I grew up at coffee shops. I even help out a little bit when I was young. I grew up at JTC canteen. So that environment was very familiar to me. I knew how to interact with hawkers, and also because I had a lot of experience interviewing people when I was in school, in Zheng school, and even after that, I freelanced quite a bit. So it was a very familiar process, and it helps that I speak Mandarin quite well. Usually, I will not be holding my. The trick is not to hold your pen and your camera, not to make it so obvious. It's just to ask uncle and to be a little bit more sampat. "为什么啊？为什么你要加这个啊?" Yeah, I mean, talk to them like a kaypo person rather than someone interviewing them. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the trick, because when I first wrote the book, I mean, like when I first started going back to the wet markets, I think I was very shy, and I didn't use Mandarin a lot. I mean, I spoke primarily English at home, right? And then, like in school, everyone thought that Mandarin was so
Oh,
uncool.
yes.
And then, like, when you start going to the wet markets, you realize that you have to be adept at using Mandarin. You know, if you're a Chinese person, they'll automatically speak to you in Mandarin, right? So yeah, it's very interesting that you have that kind of background, so you know how to banter with them, I suppose.
It helped that I was familiar with the environment. So I wasn't starting from scratch. I think they would have been irritated if you ask a lot of basic questions. Yeah. So I roughly know how things move around. And like the basic thing is not to visit them when they are busy. You have to know like which hours are like when they take a break. Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of like reading the room, but a different kind of scenario.
Yeah. Yeah,
So
exactly.
after your work at Makan Sutra, you went and took up like a few different jobs. I found that very fascinating, because you were working as a stagiaire at a Chinese American restaurant, and then an intern at a butcher shop. I mean, that is not the traditional like Singaporean path, right? Where it's very linear. So how did you navigate all these twists and turns?
That was when I was in the States. So I went to study right after Makan Sutra. I did a master's in food studies in Boston. So then after I finished my studies, I joined my husband in New York, and I had half a year to go before we come back to Singapore. And I had time, and I didn't want to waste it. And I always think that as a food writer, even though I was not planning to work in the kitchen, I thought that I should at least experience what it's like to work in the kitchen in order to write about it, right? So that's how I decided to I offered my service to a restaurant. I came across it by chance. I loved their food, and I just wrote in to the chef and said, can I work there? I mean, I don't have experience. I don't have any professional kitchen experience, but I cook at home, so I know how to hold a knife. And so he invited me to work with them. I think it's quite easy to get a job in the kitchen in New York, since they don't pay you anyway.
So how was the experience like? I mean, your glimpse into the hospitality industry.
It was interesting. I mean, I was my first day there, I was asked to weigh pasta into portions. I still remember about 170 to 180 grams, you know, the kind of attention to detail that I knew I didn't like about kitchen work. Because, I mean, like, vegetables have to be of certain size, yeah. And then you have to pluck them. I mean, I didn't enjoy cooking that way, I must say. I mean, I enjoyed cooking at home where I can be agar-agar and, you know, close one eye about certain things, be a bit, you know, but you know what, you have to be so meticulous with each vegetable leaf, and that got a bit frustrating. But I knew what I was, I mean, I knew that it was not my restaurant. I would just follow instruction. I didn't have to think so hard about it. But if you were to ask me, did I like cooking like that way? Yeah. I didn't like it.
Yeah.
But it was an eye-opening experience, and the chef was very generous with his recipes. So like, he would make ricotta with tofu roux, which is the fermented tofu, and then he would, the flavor was great, and then he would share the recipe with me, and so I learned quite a bit.
Wow, that sounds amazing. After that, did you come back to Singapore, and then you started working on your book on prison food culture?
So I found out about ex-inmates cooking in prisons and drug rehabilitation centers in the 70s and 80s back in 2011, even before I worked at Makan Sutra. So there was a point of time when I was, after I graduated, I freelanced for food magazines and I was building up my blog. So what I did was I co-called Chef
Benny, right? Was it Benny?
Yes, Chef Benny, yeah, because he was interviewed in the Straits Times, and he was talking about his past. So I co-called his restaurant. At that time, he only had one restaurant.
Yeah.
It was very easy to find him. I co-called him and I said, "Who, I'm so-and-so, you know, I'm interested to find out about what kind of food was served in prison." So he told me over the phone, "I tell you something even better. I tell you about Masak."
Yeah.
So that's how I found out about it, by being thick-skinned. And so I met up with him. He was very generous, because even though I was only preparing to like publish the story in my blog, you know, not for any mainstream like newspapers or magazines, but he was very generous with his time. He told me everything about Masa. At first, it was really very hard to wrap my head around all the concepts of, like, you know, how to build a fire from scratch and all that. So I wrote a very short story that didn't do the topic justice, because it was a very big topic. There were a lot to explore. That was why after I came back from the States, I decided to explore further, interview a few more people, and then write a book about it.
Why did you decide to publish it in like a book format? I mean, why not do like a series of blog posts? Were there any specific reasons why you chose to go with a book?
I thought it was the best format, because there were many topics to explore. I didn't think it would work if it was a series of stories. I would like to explore the different meanings of food in the prisons and drug rehabilitation center. I thought it would make more sense if it's compiled into a book. And also, I wanted pictures, like commission photography to be done about the dishes and the items that they produced. Because I think that it would be quite hard to visualize their creativity without photos. Yeah, which was why I commissioned a photographer, Don Wong, to recreate all these things and take photographs of them.
Yeah, I saw some of the photos and it's really wonderful and like really intriguing, like the kind of things that you can cook in prison with such little resources. What do you think is the impetus for these inmates to attempt cooking when it's illegal to cook in prison, right? I mean, do you think that speaks to something that's very human in all of us?
Food is a common source of joy for people. So I understand that it wasn't only in Singapore that the inmates cooked illegally in their cells. It was all over the world, in the States especially. There are a lot of stories done about that. So I think the common thing that why people of different culture in different countries did the same thing when they lost their freedom, when they are locked up, is because I think food is a common source of joy. But the second reason is because food is readily available in prisons and drug rehabilitation centers. They wouldn't deprive you of food, a basic necessity, right? As opposed to other forms of like entertainment, like alcohol or movies, that wouldn't be available in the prisons and drug rehabilitation centers. So since these were easily available, then they could exercise their creativity on these items.
So what were some of the dishes that they cooked?
So they make laksa with the noodles that, because every Wednesday they got fried noodles, and they got sick of the fried noodles that was prepared. So they saved a portion of the noodles and then they used reconstituted milk and canned hebi hyam that they could buy from the commissary. Yeah. So then they mixed them up, maybe threw in a little bit of tau kwa that they got every day. Yeah, so that's one dish. They made, like, since Chinese New Year is coming, maybe I mentioned that they made this peanut candy. They bought, you know, like camel packet peanuts from the commissary, and then they used a broom to crush it and then mixed it with margarine and sugar, I think, and then stole the, apparently the Chinese chest in the day room was hollow at the back. It was a plastic chest piece. It was hollow at the back, so they used it as a mold to mold the peanut mixture that they made.
Yeah,
and then they knock it out. So that's it. Wow. So they don't always use fire. It's not really like fire cooking all the time. They made like pickled fruits as well. Yeah, because some of the facilities they had like roadside trees. And the fruit would fall into the yard, and then they would pick up the mangoes and then pickle it.
Yeah. Do you think, you know, creating all these foods were a matter of like recreating familiar tastes and flavors to them when they were outside of prison? Or do you think it was something like they needed that kind of mental stimulation to exercise their creativity? Or do you think it was like all of the above?
When I asked, the interesting thing is when I asked them if they were trying to recreate familiar food, they said no. But most of the recipes they shared with me were actually hawker food or food that are available outside. So I think it wasn't their intention to try to recreate familiar food, but they just wanted something. Firstly, the reason why they must have is they wanted something hot to eat, because prison meals were always served cold. They had to prepare the meals much earlier, you know, because of logistical issues and the delivery takes quite a while. They just really wanted something hot, and when they tried to cook, they cooked something that they had eaten before. I guess that's natural. You wouldn't try to cook like something altogether new to you. So it was by chance that they created things like laksa and ban mian and peanut candy.
I find it very amazing that they managed to cook such like elaborate sounding things secretly. Like, did they tell you what the process was to do it, you know, in secret?
To be honest, actually the warders knew what they were doing. So, but remember that was in the 70s and 80s. So a few things going on there. There was a short of staff in the drug rehabilitation centers back in the 70s. And they were familiar with the patrol hours, right? So they would do it not in the face of the warders. So they would time it after the last muster check, which is the last head count after dinner, and they locked up all the gates, right? And then that's around 7 o'clock, and 9 o'clock it's lights out. So they would muster up between that time. And there would be no warders patrolling during that time. Yeah. So they would cook very quickly, and then they would clean up. And they would also, you know, like, they would see who's patrolling that day. If it's someone who they know is quite lenient, they would mask up. But, you know, they say, this one will catch one, then they would not mask up.
And how did you start the fire?
Okay. In the prison, they used to be allowed to smoke. So they had matches there. But if you were in a drug rehabilitation center, then you would have to use like a flint that is found in like a little metal piece found in the lighter, and then they would strike it with a razor blade that they used to shave. They were supposed to surrender it after they are done shaving, but you know, they hid it, or they use a pen knife that they stole from the workshop to create a spark. Then they stole a cotton ball from the clinic. And then they aim the spark at the cotton ball then the cotton ball would catch fire. And then that fire, they use it to char a piece of cloth that they cut out from the T-shirt. So that would be their black coal that they then tear every time they need a small piece. And then they would then again use the flint and the razor blade, create a spark, aim at that piece of coal, and then it's their fire. They don't need the cotton ball anymore. So it's a very elaborate process, a bit Flintstone-like. And then they have to create their own fuel. Like they would like break the plastic trays and then melt it down to make a candle. And then that is their little stove then that they light up. The wick is made of T-shirt or their socks.
Yeah, I really feel like stories like that is like, they are like testament to the human spirit, right? Like what humans can actually do.
Yeah, when you're severely deprived, right?
No, not just deprived, but I mean like when you have constraints placed upon you, then like you really see the true nature of humans, which is that, you know, we are inherently creative beings, right? Like I feel that now in this era of abundance, we kind of have lost this culinary ingenuity, right? So when you were recreating these dishes at home, what did you feel? I mean, when you were cooking them and tasting them, did you have any thoughts?
Oh, I didn't recreate them. Don did.
Oh.
I didn't get to because he did it during circuit breaker. So we couldn't meet.
Oh.
I mean, we did meet outside, and then he showed me the photos, and I told him what's wrong about these. Oh, they didn't use this ingredient, so we shouldn't put that in. Yeah, so I gave him my input, but he was the one who did the shopping, tried to find similar looking like colors and cloth, you know, to recreate the items that the ex-inmates did. Okay, this is what my interviewees told me. Like some of them actually tried creating the things that the food that they did after they were released.
Oh, but why would you do that?
Look, so they remembered it to be wonderful. They remembered those dishes to be wonderful, right? So they thought that, oh, I want to prepare it for my family today, right? So there was this, I call it mixed stew, because they simply threw everything that was available to them into that pot of soup. It was a lot of canned food, canned pig trotters, giam tai, you know, they threw everything in, tau kwa. So my interviewee did the same. He even threw in abalone and, you know, like jazz it up. And then nobody could eat it because it was so salty. Because all the canned, all the sauce in the canned food, he threw it in as he did when he was in the drug rehabilitation center. So then he said that made him realize that, I mean, it was wonderful then because prison food was quite blend.
Yeah.
Right. But when he came out, he realized that actually it wasn't that good. Yeah. And this was quite consistent. I mean, a lot of the other interviewees told me the same thing. I mean, why would I make the prison nasi lemak when there's Punggol nasi lemak outside?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So now, like, well, now that when you're out, maybe even Punggol nasi lemak isn't good enough for you. That's what exactly yeah. what one of them said.
I think what you're saying reminds me of this episode that I did with Shen Tan. Mm-hmm. And because Shen, she practices fasting, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so she was telling me that when you actually deprive yourself of dopamine for a while, like the next thing that you taste is like the best tasting thing in the world, right? And I was like,
hunger.
Oh, you know,
that's hunger is the best sauce.
Yeah. Can I also ask why you decided to shine a spotlight on this side of Singaporean food culture? I think, like, to a lot of people, like, this is something that feels irrelevant to, you know, daily living because it's like something that not every Singaporean experiences. So why did you feel like it was noteworthy or, you know, worthy enough to be published into a book?
Food is merely an excuse for me to find out more about something bigger. Yeah, I thought that this whole masak thing was very interesting because it shows us a different side of the inmates.
Mm. In what sense? Like, did you feel like there was a stereotype? Or
there is. I mean, I wrote this in my book as well. I mean, our understanding of inmates is they are either repentant or they are incorrigible. It's black and white, right?
Yeah.
But I think that the massage shows them to be a bit more multifaceted.
Mm.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. it shows them to be loyal, but it shows them to be ill-disciplined. It shows them to be angry, but funny as well. So that's why I want to... I mean, I learned something from trying to understand massage, and I simply wanted to tell that story, and that's it.
I love that. So when you were talking and interviewing these inmates, like, did that aspect of them come through? Like, I mean, because they were telling you about things that you were not witness to, right? So did that side of their personality come through in their recounting?
Yes, it did. I think every time I interviewed them, I would ask myself what surprised me, and like, for example, when I shared with my husband, oh, you know, this guy, he told me this and that, and I found that surprising. And then I would think to myself, why was I surprised? Is it because I had a preconceived notion of who they are, what they were like, you know? And then I would catch that and make sure that I would capture that in the story that I write about them. I can't remember what exactly it was, but why was this particular information so surprising to me? And I would investigate that and make sure to deliver that in the story that I write, yeah.
Mm. Can I ask you a personal question?
Yeah.
Your whole career has been you following your own passions, right? Like, and your curiosities, like what you're curious about. Do you see this as a sustainable way of living? I mean, like, for example, with publishing a book, right? Like, say, the prison book. What some people would do is that they'll test for, like, market demand and see whether people would be keen to purchase such a book before working on it. But I think for you, what I found very fascinating is that you actually, like, just went ahead with it, not knowing, like, how people would respond to such a unorthodox subject or, you know, topic. Yeah, so I mean, I was just curious about how can it be, like, sustainable what you're doing?
We get asked that question a lot. Okay, so first thing is that my husband showed me that it is possible to start our own company. Okay, basically, we graduated in 2009. It was the subprime mortgage crisis, no one was hiring, and he happened to be offered a freelance job, and somehow he managed to survive, so he has never been employed until today. So whereas I got myself a job at a tour agency, and then I quit my job, I did some freelancing, I also did petrochemicals reporting. They pay very well, but I couldn't care about the numbers, whether the cost of ethanol has gone up by 1 cent or 2 cents that day. I mean, having tried that, I knew very well that I wouldn't enjoy it even though it pays well. That's how I decided that. Then right after that, I joined Makan Sutra basically. So from those experiences, I know very well what makes me happy. It's food writing, right? But of course, if I were to do the kind of stories that I do, I mean, I don't fit into the mainstream magazines or newspapers, right? Makan Sutra didn't give me the luxury too, because we had a partnership with Yahoo. So I could write a lot of, I could propose stories that I was interested to find out more about, and I could write about them. So that was good. But I want to be out on my own. I wanted to find out more, other ways I could interpret food culture. That's why I went to study, because I had a lot of interest. Like the prison story, for example, I didn't know how to analyze the information that I have. That's why I wanted to study. I had interest in home economics history in Singapore as well, even before I went to study, but I didn't know how to approach it. That was the main reason why I wanted to go to study, because I was ill-equipped to write those stories. And coming back, my husband basically continued doing what he was doing, and I joined him. He already had some clients who were familiar with him, and then we got jobs, and we agreed that the kind of interest that we have are not going to be sustainable, are not going to pay the bills. So what we did was we basically do editorial work, we write stories for government agencies, we do books for private companies, we did this kind of things to pay for the projects that we really like to do.
I think that's such a good way to think about it.
I mean, we met people who did similar stuff as well. So we learned from them that, you don't have to think about it in like binary terms. Either you do what you hate and it pays you well, or you do what you like and then become a pauper. you don't have to choose between the two, But of course, I must say that we were lucky also. My husband had already been freelancing. I mean, he registered a company as well, so he owns a company. And then it's been doing well. So we were quite confident that we could make it work. It was not as if I graduated and then I planned it so well and then everything just fell into place. It wasn't like that at all. It was really very difficult deciding whether, I remember back then in 2012, 2013, it was very difficult to decide whether I want to be a food writer or to continue petrochemical reporting. Mm. Because the salary was a very big difference. Mm. Yeah. And I had to pay my student loan then as well.
So how do you decide on food writing being your eventual career?
I guess how I felt while reporting petrochemical prices, and how I felt when I was talking to hawkers and writing about stories, was just the difference was just too obvious to me. And I thought that it would be easier to make it work if I enjoy what I'm doing. It might take me a little longer to get comfortable in life, but I think the process wouldn't be too painful if I was doing what I like. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's very interesting, because I was reading your blog, and they are really meaty articles, like almost like deep dives into specific subjects. I think I read your article on toddy, and I was like, wow, it's like very long and very like well researched, and I think it's really wonderful to see you actually breaking the mold and finding what keeps you happy, but also is sustainable in its own way for you.
Yeah, if I were a runner, I would definitely not be a sprinter. I'm a marathon runner. I mean, I don't run at all. I have no stamina. But if I were to be a runner, I would be a marathon runner. So like the Singapore Noodles story, right? There are actually many, there have been many articles written about Singapore Noodles. And I would always be very curious, did I miss out anything that these writers actually found out, but I didn't. I get very nervous, right? Then I read, then I realize that these writers, because they work for magazines, right, they don't have the luxury that I do to take my own sweet time to research about one dish. So their articles would never be as rich as mine or as in-depth as mine because they really do not have, like they have deadlines that I do not have. But it's not sustainable, I have to say. Like, to take one whole day to research about something so small that doesn't even give you any answer about a dish, yeah.
But I completely empathize with you. I mean, which is one of the reasons why I really wanted to reach out to you to have this chat, because I see a lot of parallels between your life and your interests and my own. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I saw a lot of similarities. And then now I'm in this phase that's like almost very similar to what you're doing with this, which is a lot of research about food. And I can also spend like an entire day researching about like one thing just because it feeds my passion and my interest. But I guess why I asked you about the sustainable question is because, you know, like the thing is, I'm not sure if it's information that people really need. You know what I mean? It's like, Good to know that there's a history, but I mean, people crave that kind of content?
I get what you mean. I guess this is a question that I've been thinking about as well, and it may be the reason why I have lost a bit of my curiosity about food. I don't blame COVID entirely. I think it's partly because I haven't found the answer to that question. Like, is it really important? What am I doing this for? Like the things that I'm curious about, I guess, which is why in the past, my research has mostly been about people. I always thought that if my food stories are actually about people, then it's easier to convince myself why these stories are important, because it's about people, right? But when it comes to topics that are less about people, or it's just to feed my curiosity about. No, actually, now that you know, I'm thinking a lot right now. Actually, every story is about people.
Yeah, in some way, when it's about food, right?
Yeah. Maybe that's something that we could remind ourselves.
Yeah. Like, for example, you know, like things like toddy. It's like something that is so obscure. It's like people in Singapore don't even think about toddy. But you would take, like, I don't know how long you took to write that article. But, I mean, you definitely took a lot of time and effort to do that research and to put it all into a, you know, cohesive and eloquent piece of writing, right?
Researching is always the fun part for me.
Yeah.
What's agonizing is the writing. I always find writing difficult, although it's been my job, but I always find writing very difficult. But it's a very important process to make sure that I actually understand what I think I understood. That process is very important for me. But researching is really, really very fun. Like, then you will come across information that is totally unimportant but could be quite funny as well.
You know, I never used to like history as a student. I hated history, but it was only through working on Singapore Noodles and finding out about like the context, cultural context behind certain dishes that makes me feel like I want to know more about history, you know, because everyone is connected in a way.
Yes.
Like, food is not static, it doesn't belong to a single country. Yes. And then like when you trace the origins and the pathways, it's very, very fascinating. Being in this food writing space, do you feel that there are any areas of food writing or in the Singaporean food space that has been overlooked?
One thing that I did notice about food media in Singapore is that it is dominated by the Chinese food writers. So then we are seeing things from the eyes of the Chinese. I mean, I face challenges as well as a ethnic Chinese food researcher is that whenever I try to find out more about a Malay dish, for example, because of my inability to read Malay, I'm restricted to English newspapers, for example, or English language resources. And I'm well aware that then I would only be seeing things from an English-speaking person's perspective. Especially if you were to go far back to like maybe the early 1900s, then the Straits Times were like written by your European writers, right? So that was the challenge that I faced, and then I therefore wonder about then isn't that a problem? Is your mainstream newspapers, all your food writers are Chinese?
Yeah, I understand what you mean. Like, it's kind of like, even if the Chinese person was well-meaning, he or she would be locked out of a culture or a sense of food appreciation that can only be there if you are belonging to the ethnic group, right?
Yeah, or at least if you are well-versed in the language, then you would have access to a very different set of information or opinion. I can read Chinese, so it helps a lot. I find that like when I was researching Singapore noodles, for example, I could read up the Chinese papers, and they would tell me things that the English newspapers wouldn't tell me. Okay, regardless of what ethnicity you are, I just feel that it's not enough to be only to master only one language. Yeah, considering how intertwined our food cultures are, if you understand only English or Mandarin alone, then you would be locked out from a whole lot of other information that is available out there. You are seeing things from a very, very small, narrow angle.
Yeah, and I think it's a very humbling process for a Chinese person also, to really realize that there's so much that you don't know.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't realize how much I didn't know until I started working on Singapore noodles. I mean, in the past, when you're growing up in Singapore, I was like, you know, it's so funny that this perspective that I grew up about, you know, this notion of Singaporean food, it's very like, oh, what is Singaporean food? It's chicken rice, nasi lemak, mee rebus, you know what I mean? But like, when you dig deeper, there's actually so much that is not shared about, so much that is not talked about, so much that is not represented fairly in the media. So yeah, I think it's a long road, and it's definitely a marathon, not a sprint like what you said.
Yeah, I get asked the question, what is Singapore food, a lot, and I always like struggle to... If you talk about like chicken rice, then not everyone eat chicken rice. When I was younger, I'm not sure if you remember that there were Muslim chicken rice stores, and their chicken rice is a little bit different from a Chinese, Hainanese chicken rice. So that got me thinking, you know, when we talk about how chicken rice represents Singapore food, but then my question is, what kind of chicken rice are you talking about? Or Hokkien Mee? It doesn't really represent like it. These are food that certain communities actually don't take at all. And then we also like leave out things like, I mean, these are food that we have been eating for decades. But how about the food that represents our new immigrants? They are not included at all. How come Mala Sangko is not Singapore food?
Yeah,
they are so popular now. It's very glaring. It's very glaring that there are certain communities that are like excluded in the representation of what Singapore food is.
Yeah, I think that just leaves space for both of us to, you know, to explore in our own works, lah. And I think it's a very meaningful, and I'm very excited to read your future articles or like to follow your work.
Thank you so much for reading my work. Sometimes I update my blog and I wonder who's reading it. Especially when I started earlier. Now I know there are people reading it, but when I first started it 10 years ago, never mind, I'll just write.
Yeah, you should. But yeah, I'm so happy that we got to finally meet, virtually meet and chat. Yeah, it's been so lovely, and I hope that we stay in touch.
Yes, please do. I love talking to you.
That wraps up another episode of the Singapore Noodles podcast. You have been listening to Sherry Ng, who is the author of When Cooking Was a Crime and co-founder of In Plain Words. Chinese New Year is around the corner, and if you're looking forward to making your own pineapple tarts this year, you can get a step-by-step guide if you sign up to our newsletter at sgpnoodles.substack.com. That is S-U-B-S-T-A-C-K. Once again, thank you for listening to the podcast, and I'll catch you next week.